What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, Social Media and Athletic Trainers. My guest is Jody Kinnemer, Legal Counsel for Pasadena Independent School District. Jody has presented a couple of times about social media use and inappropriate relationships between teacher and student. And in the presentation, one of the things she said was that most of the situations were with either a coach or like a fine arts instructor, like a band teacher, something like that. Because you spend a lot of time, a lot of times you have more than just regular contact. You might have their phone number and it's after hours and that kind of thing. So you develop more of a relationship. But we're going to talk about some of the ways to kind of prevent that, to keep yourself safeguarded, and ways to stay out of jail. So I am your host, Jeremy Jackson. And beside me today, we've got
Edgar,
Alexia,
Kimani,
Felicia,
Natalie,
and the rest of my students doing other different jobs. If you want to join the conversation, again, the show notes will be sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/jailtime. Again, staying out of jail is important. So sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/jailtime. All right. So Jody has a presentation. She's going to kind of talk through that. Also, again, I have that linked in the show notes there. And so she's going to go through those slides kind of one at a time, and we'll explain everything as we go. So Jody, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me. As Jeremy said, my name is Jody Kinnemer. I'm the general counsel for the Pasadena Independent School District. I have been a lawyer licensed in Texas since 2011, and my entire legal career has been focused on the representation of school districts across the state of Texas. So I worked for a firm that specialized in school law prior to joining PISD as its general counsel. Prior to joining PISD, and then both after I've joined PISD, I have presented on the same topic, similar PowerPoint presentations. You know, as the law changes, we add more to it and adapt and tweak those a little bit. But this is pretty much the exact same PowerPoint presentation that all of our coaches in PISD and all of our fine arts folks in PISD received this year prior to the start of the school year. So why do we typically talk about it? The first and the number one reason that we talk about it is because Texas is number one in the nation for teacher-student relationships. It's not something that we're particularly proud of, but we have got some different reporting requirements that some other states don't have that we'll talk about a little later. We also have a very large number of teachers and students. For example, you know, Texas is a much bigger state than Oklahoma, so we are inherently going to have, you know, be at a higher risk for things like this to happen. Educator investigations in Texas, as you can see, SBEC, the State Board for Educator Certification, is the agency or the body that's responsible for conducting educator investigations in Texas. And as they have existed over the last, I don't know, I think this PowerPoint slide goes from 2011 to 2016 because that's the most recent data we have. Each year, the number of educator investigations in Texas has climbed. During 2016, there were over, I think it's 1,010 or 1,110 educator investigations in the state. Texas stats in 2015 and 16, all four quarters of the year, out of the investigations that were performed, the State Board for Educator Certification issued 909 sanctions. So 58% of those opened investigations involved some sort of sexual misconduct, violence, sexual harassment, or some kind of inappropriate relationship between a student and minor. 381 cases specifically involved sexual misconduct, sexual harassment, or inappropriate relationship with a student or minor. And then specifically out of that 381, 222 were inappropriate relationships with a student or minor. In 2014-15, there were 188 sanctions that were issued. I'm so wrong. That's incorrect. The 188 are the investigations that were inappropriate relationships with a student or minor. So in 2014-15, there were 188 investigations of an educator for an inappropriate relationship with a student or minor. And that was a 27% increase over the last 3 years prior to that. But in 2013, the rules changed on who was reported and who was going to be investigated. So that kind of helps account for that jump or increase in the number of investigations in that particular category. That was also a seven-year high. It's continued to grow each year after 2014-15. So I think we're at an 8 or 9 year high in that category now. Moving along, what about 2016-17? We don't have full fiscal year totals yet. Quarters 1 through 3 included 569 sanctions. The problem is that fourth quarter includes the summer, which is slow time for teachers, so more investigations can get done because witnesses and contacts are more available. So we see a very large number of sanctions issued in that last quarter, and I would expect once the final, you know, quarter year totals are out that it would be close to, if not more than, the 909 that were issued during the previous year. Let's see. Okay, so who engages in inappropriate relationships? We go back to that 2014-15 school year data because that's the year that we have data for. Out of those 188 investigations that were inappropriate relationships with a student or minor, males were perpetrators in 2/3 of the students, meaning a male teacher was engaged in the conduct 2 out of 3 times. 44% of cases involve some sort of social media. But then female perpetrators used social media at least 40% of the time, which was higher than male use of social media, which was 35% of the time. Almost all cases involve some sort of texting. So in this particular context, texting is different than social media. When I refer to social media, I'm talking about Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter, Kick Messenger. I don't even know what else is out there at this point. You guys probably know much more than I do with respect to that. But then the concerning part is that the employees that were involved, some, you know, as Jeremy said earlier, that were involved in some sort of extracurricular activities, specifically coaches and then, you know, our band and fine arts folks, were the highest category of employees that engaged or in inappropriate relationships or were being investigated for engaging in some sort of inappropriate conduct with a student or minor. Okay, so this is my slide where I just show coaches or fine arts folks. I switch it out for my fine arts folks. We talk about, you know, these are all of the different people within the last year that, you know, have made the news in some shape, form, or fashion about engaging in inappropriate relationships. It's rather concerning what a Google search will find, and you don't want your name plastered.
As I was discussing before, like just 10 minutes before you guys got here, I just saw something on Facebook. There was a band director in the greater Houston area that was accused of having a relationship. And like the student has graduated, but apparently it started while the student was there at the school. And therefore,
yeah, we'll touch on that later. But, okay. You know, plans for post-graduation dating or marriage are still subject an educator to being reported to SBEC and potentially losing their teaching credentials. So yeah, that's concerning too. I mean, it's funny when, you know, you hear all of the different stories and you think, okay, well, they're both consenting adults over the age of 18. So what difference does it make now? Well, then, you know, SBEC and Texas Education Agency wants to look at, how did they meet this person? How did they come in contact? Did it begin when they were a student? Because if so, then that's still considered an inappropriate relationship in Texas, especially for an educator. So how's it happening is the question I get most often, is how does this keep happening? People, you know, they see the news, they see their name in the news. What's going on? And I said, you know, it has to do a lot with social media. About 80% of youth ages 12 through 17 own a cell phone. 94% of youth have a Facebook account. You know, we don't have numbers or totals on who has Snapchat, who has Instagram, who has Kick. I mean, what's another popular one at this point? Twitter?
Who else?
Twitter. Yeah.
Anything else besides Twitter that she didn't mention?
Instagram.
Anything else?
There's this plethora of ways that we can contact each other that we might not have had in the past. And I always talk about keyboard courage. People are more inclined to say something via, you know, text or the internet or a social media site that they wouldn't necessarily say or do in real life, in person. So I think it increases the chances of something like this happening. A Pew research that was done in, I think it was 14-15, said only 43% of parents know their kid's cell phone password? How many of you guys, how many, do your parents know your cell phone passwords? No, okay.
They do, Adrian? Can you download apps without your parents?
Yeah. I mean, you can.
I know some parents don't allow their, like, they have the Apple password, so right. They can't download apps without their parent, kind of thing.
And then, you know, they said 35% of parents know the password to one of their teens' social media accounts. Only one account would they know the password. Do any of your parents know the passwords to your Facebook or your Instagram or your Twitters?
No.
Yours.
I see a couple nodding heads. Is that the condition that your parents place on it for you to be able to use it? Yeah. And that's so they can monitor it. So that's the next reason is, you know, not only does everybody have access to the social media and these tools for communication, but then we also have parents who aren't supervising any of that communication. And I know you guys are high schoolers and you don't want your parents in your business or supervising your online communication. But from a legal perspective, I want that involvement, because if an educator is doing something, you know, inappropriate, your parent who has more life experience than you have is much more likely to catch on that, hey, that's crossing a line, and is much more likely to report it faster than a student is. So what about educators? 4 out of 5 educators use some sort of social media. More than 62% of educators report having absolutely no training in how to interact with students and parents through social media. And then the Texas Education Agency said as much as 90% of the inappropriate teacher-student relationships start through texting or social media. So that's going back to that keyboard courage thing that I mentioned earlier is, you know, we have this ability to say things to people that we wouldn't typically say in person. And it kind of de-identifies us because we're doing it, you know, behind a cell phone or behind a computer screen. So what is actually against the rules? In Texas, in the Texas Administrative Code, the state legislature has adopted, or TEA has promulgated and adopted, the Educator Code of Ethics. And that's going to be found in Pasadena ISD board policy, and really any school district in the state of Texas's board policy, at DH Exhibit. And so at DH Exhibit, there are specific things that it lists. It has a section about, you know, conduct with colleagues, conduct with students, conduct in general. But specifically in the section with conduct about students, it prohibits, or it provides that an educator shall maintain an appropriate professional educator-student relationship. And the boundaries of that relationship should be based on a reasonably prudent educator standard. So what that means is it's not what you think might be okay as a teacher, but it's what teachers collectively at large think, what the reasonable person, what the reasonable teacher would think looking at those circumstances. And then it, you know, specifically says an educator shall not solicit or engage in sexual conduct or a romantic relationship with a student or minor. And then it spells out that an educator should refrain from inappropriate communication with a student or minor. And then it goes on to define that and says, you know, it includes but not limited to cell phone, text messages, email, instant messaging, blogging, other social network communication. And then it gives us some factors that we could look at to determine whether or not the communication was appropriate.
All right, so let me ask you a question real quick. During Hurricane Harvey, I texted several of my students, hey, are you okay? Do you guys need any help? So in a situation like that, again, everything I did, there was nothing questionable. I just said, are you okay? You guys need any help? Do you need help at your house, moving stuff, pulling up carpet? Is that questionable?
So for me, typically I would say that alone is probably not, because when you look at the factors, they're going to look at the nature, purpose, timing, and amount of the communication. So when I look at the nature of the communication, it was during a storm. The purpose of the communication was to see if your students were in danger or they needed some sort of assistance. The timing of the communication, I'm sure it was at normal, appropriate hours and wasn't at 2 a.m, you know. The amount of the communication, it's going to be fairly limited in amount because it was specific to that situation. The subject matter of the communication, you were asking specifically about the storm and their health and making sure they were okay or whether they needed assistance. The next one is whether the communication was made openly or the educator attempted to conceal the communication. So you're not sending the messages and deleting them off of your phone. You know, if your boss came to you and said, Jeremy, I heard you texted students during Harvey, my guess is that you would go, yep, here's my phone. You want to look at it? I'll print every text message I sent for you. You know, and so typically what I find is when we get an issue and that comes up, and it was something that was reasonable, the educator willingly gives over everything they have. There is no attempt to conceal that communication. And so then the next thing you look at is whether it could be reasonably interpreted as soliciting sexual contact or romantic relationship. I highly doubt asking, you know, about whether or not they need help during Harvey could be reasonably interpreted as that. Whether it was sexually explicit, my guess is it wasn't, you know. Whether the communication involved discussions about the physical or sexual attractiveness or sexual history or activities or preferences or fantasies of either party. You know, so when we have the communication and you're willing to provide it, we can definitely analyze it on that basis. And I've even had situations in particular where we couldn't get the context of the communication. But because a parent, you know, is willing to print off their child's text messaging history, we can go through months of records and highlight everything between, you know, the number of the coach and the number of the student and show that, you know, coach and student sent 2,000 text messages over 2 months between the hours of 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. So even with that information, I can say, okay, the timing and amount of the communication is inappropriate. So, you know, if the educator's not providing us with the context of it, he's attempting to conceal it. So based on those factors, I have a much higher likelihood to go, okay, I don't know the specific content, but a reasonably prudent educator is not going to text their student 2,000 times over 2 months between the hours of 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. and then not be willing to share the content of it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it really is kind of a common sense approach. Let's look at the factors. Let's see, is this, you know, does it pass the smell test? Does it pass the creep factor? You know, is it that there or no? Hot off the press, in the 2017 legislative session, during the 85th regular legislative session, they passed Senate Bill 7. And part of Senate Bill 7 added a new standard to the Educator Code of Ethics. And what it says is that the educator cannot assist another educator in obtaining a new job in a school apart from just sending their human resource file, essentially, if the educator that's sending the information knew or has reasonable belief to believe that the person requesting it engaged in sexual misconduct regarding a student or minor. So basically, if you're an educator and your buddy gets caught in this inappropriate relationship with a student or minor and you're aware of it, you are in fact prohibited from helping that friend get a job at another school. If you, you know, ignore that and proceed with sending him references and calling your other friends at other schools trying to find him a job, then you can potentially put your teaching certificate or your certification on the line. So Texas is starting to, you know, tighten up those rules even a little bit more than we currently have. And then our board policy also defines solicitation of romantic relationship. And it means, you know, deliberate or repeated acts that can be reasonably interpreted as solicitation of a student by an educator. You know, this is pretty common sense. We have, it gives us some specific acts that, you know, we can consider. You'll notice a lot of these are the same factors that we can consider for text messaging or social media communication. They look at all sorts of behaviors, what's related to the educator's job duties. Is there a romantic interest or intent? You know, were there any statements of love, affection, or attraction that were made? Some factors, you know, nature, timing, extent of communication, whether it was made openly or secretly, if the educator attempted to hide it. Here's a good one, too, to remember that I always point out is if the educator claims to be counseling a student, then the State Board for Educator Certification is going to look at the educator's job description to determine what part of their job is counseling. Because a teacher's here to teach, a teacher's not here to counsel. So technically, once it crosses that line into counseling, educators are supposed to refer students to the counselor for that sort of advice, because they're not, you know, they have minimal training in that area, and their expertise doesn't allow them to appropriately, you know, engage with a student on that sort of level. And then the other thing they look at is, Okay, if you were counseling it, who did you report it to that you were counseling it? Did you refer the student to counseling? Did you tell your boss about it? You know, is it abuse or neglect because you knew the student needed serious counseling and didn't refer them? So there's and lots so of questions
on
that,
that
brings
counseling,
up.
Counseling, that's really referring again to the text messaging, social media type stuff. Because yeah. if I have a kid that just busted up his knee and, you know, he's coming in to see me and I'm counseling him about how to work through it and those kind of things, that's not the same thing that you're talking about.
Right. So I mean specifically with respect to social media communication and then even just general communication. What I've seen in the past in cases that I've worked through is that an educator that is having an inappropriate relationship, they will push that off and say, no, we're not talking about, you know, I'm counseling them. I'm talking to the, you know, them about their family situation because they're in a rough situation in their home life and their, you know, their dad isn't involved and they need a father figure. So I'm counseling them in that regard. I'm helping them. And that's when we ask, okay, to what extent, you know, if their family life is that rough or they have, you know, serious concerns or issues with their father, then they need counseling beyond what a teacher can provide. They need counseling, you know, that a counselor is trained to give. Gotcha. Make sense?
Yep.
Yeah. So, and then any other evidence that we find tending to show that there was a relationship, making inappropriate comment, you know, these are just more of the things that we can consider, whether or not they made inappropriate comments about a student's body or tried to send, you know, nudes. Can't send nudes. That's not allowed, unfortunately. You can't have nude pictures of your teacher. Your teacher can't have nude pictures of you. You'd be surprised how often. That's why I say it. Making sexually demeaning comments to a student. You know, they can't make comments. They can't make comments about a student's potential sexual performance. Requesting details of a student's sexual history, requesting a date, sexual conduct, or any activity intended for the sexual gratification of the educator is not allowed. Engaging in conversations regarding the sexual problems, preferences, or fantasies of either party. This is one I caution folks against because sometimes the kid comes in and he wants to vent about his girlfriend problems or boyfriend problems, or and I say, nope, you know, don't touch it with a 10-foot pole, because that's where you're going to get yourself in trouble, is when you start having those intimate conversations with students. Inappropriate hugging, kissing, touching, providing students with drugs or alcohol is also considered inappropriate relationship with a student or minor, even though it's not sexual in nature. You know, remember, it doesn't always have to be sexual. Suggestions, here's the one that got the banned person that you mentioned earlier, is that suggestions that a romantic relationship is desired after the student graduates, including post-graduation plans for dating or marriage. That's also very not allowed under it's, you know, under the educator code of ethics in Texas. And then any acts tending to show that the educator solicited or engaged in a romantic relationship with the student. Like and there that's a little bit different. The post-graduation plans for dating or marriage, there are two very distinct things that come into play there. There is the educator side, and, you know, do you get to keep your teaching certificate and continue to be a teacher in Texas? And then there is the, you know, do you go to jail or prison because, you know, you've done something illegal? Well, if they didn't have, you know, sexual relations until the student was over the age of 18, it may not be a criminal crime in Texas, but the Texas Education Agency, through the State Board for Educator Certification, is very unlikely to let you keep your teaching certificate. So, you know, you might get to keep your life outside of prison, but you're not going to get to keep your career as an educator. You're going to have to switch and find some other career to follow. So teacher organizations say the same thing. They warn our teachers to, you know, think about what they're doing, to think about the appropriateness of their actions, ensure that the content of messages and communications are age appropriate, are, you know, appropriate for the situation. Just more of it. You know, remember to protect yourself. Remember professionalism. Remember your role as a teacher. You are required to be a role model as a teacher. So not so much of a friend, right? There's a difference between a friend and a role model. And so we try to push our teachers to be more on that role model side than the I want to be everybody's friend phase. Because that tends to open them up for that kind of allegations, even if they're not true, and liability. This is an excerpt from a teacher's voluntary statement that was provided to law enforcement during one of the educator investigations. And I'm going to read a piece of it to you just because I think it's pretty powerful. He said, I began playing Words with Friends with several students before the end of the school year, including Gabriella. I often chatted with students about the game. My conversations began innocently, but after school let out in June, my conversations with Gabriella became more intense. I told my wife I had an emotional relationship with Gabriella, and it moved beyond an appropriate boundary between a teacher and student. My wife was angry.
No kidding, right?
And demanded that I terminate contact with Gabriella entirely. I then emailed her and asked her to try not in contact me or my wife, and I apologized for any emotional harm I had caused her. Do you want to guess what happened to this teacher? Come on. He went to jail. For how long do you think he went to jail?
10 years.
Anybody got a different guess?
5 years.
How many?
60.
60. You can see it. You read it. Yes, he was sentenced to prison for 60 years. I can tell you that there's probably a lot more to that statement that they didn't give us to get sentenced to prison for 60 years, much more than an emotional affair. Here's more excerpts from a teacher's voluntary statement. Why did I act this way? I honestly don't know. I think it had a lot to do with two things, extreme loneliness and severe depression. Basically, I have no friends, certainly none in this town. This is probably the reason I'm so depressed. I started to feel closeness with her and was drawn to it. I don't know what I was thinking. So again, this is where we warn our teachers. Your job is not to be their friend. Seek adult friendship with your colleagues or your coworkers, not your students. That, you know, it is a real line in the sand. And I know for a lot of educators that are young, you know, they are 22 coming out of college, 21 sometimes, and they have an 18 or 19 year old senior. While that might normally be okay, due to the position you have put yourself in as an educator, you are supposed to be the responsible adult, regardless of whether it would be consensual otherwise. This is an excerpt from a student statement. She said, I'm writing this letter not to stir up drama or controversy, but because I now have the confidence and courage to say that Mr. Benedict is a predator. He gains the trust of female students and slowly makes advances at them. He exploits his power and authority as a teacher to manipulate female students. That's pretty powerful. You know, I mean, when you have kids that are recognizing this sort of behavior and are able to articulate it in this manner, you know, we just have to hammer down and think about the harm that we can be causing to a child. I mean, and I know you guys don't feel like children. You're all old enough. You're at the point where you're like, I'm almost an adult, you know, a couple more years and I'm free. But you know, there's research that shows that your brain is not fully developed until you're, what, 25, I think, on average?
Something like that.
So 25, 26 years old. So there is still a difference in your mental thought process and your mental thinking and your ability to process information and respond appropriately in you know, in a manner that is all right. So reporting misconduct, I always call this one to stick your nose in someone else's business because, you know, we try to mind our own and then there are times we should mind others. And reporting misconduct is definitely one of those. A superintendent is required to report to SBEC if a person resigns or is terminated based on, you know, whether the person sexually or physically abused or otherwise committed an unlawful act with a student or minor. That includes the next one, which is involved in a romantic relationship with a student or minor. And then in the Texas legislature this year, I told you, you know, they kind of hammered down and made things a little bit more difficult. They expanded the definition of inappropriate relationship between an educator and a student to include anyone in a position that requires SBEC certification, even if they are not... So, for example, I don't know, Jeremy, does your position require... Were you required to hold an SBEC certificate?
I have one because I taught biology, but
right.
as an athletic trainer, currently you do not have to be teacher certified because your state license works as your teacher license.
Right. So, okay. So part of the reason that they changed these rules, for example, though, is you are acting as a teacher in your teacher classrooms,
mm-hmm.
you know. So typically an educator would require it. So, for example, if you were an athletic trainer and you did not have an SBEC certification, but by virtue of teaching, you're required to hold one, you know, or your position typically requires one, you would still be reportable to SBEC, even though you may not have an ESPEC certificate, which is strange.
Athletic trainers, especially outside of Texas, that are not teachers. They'll come in at, 2 o'clock or something like that. But if they're still in the position to where they have like student aides or something like that, maybe they're not in the classroom teaching, then does it still count?
Yeah. I mean, I think it definitely still counts. As far as in Texas, if you hold an educator certificate, it counts. I mean, the penalties imposed against a superintendent and even now against a principal for failure to report is potentially, revocation of their superintendent certification or their principal certification. And then there's no penalty as long as they reported in good faith, which means they didn't maliciously do it knowing that the information they were reporting was false. So they have there's really almost no discretion not to report. It is if you think, by the hair of your chinny chin chin that it might be true, you report it. And then they also expanded the definition of student to include anyone enrolled in a Texas public K-12 school. So it used to be student at your school. Now it's any student in Texas. And then the criminal prohibition applies regardless of the student's age. So technically you can get in trouble for engaging in an inappropriate sexual relationship with a student. And I will say sexual because if we catch it before it goes there, then you can get in trouble with ESPEC, but you might not be able to get in trouble with the law. But once you cross the sex line, then you can get in trouble with both, your ESPEC and the law. And so there are certain things that they added so that it would, the student's age is not even a question for criminal liability. And then that's specific with regard to if the kid is in school where you work, it doesn't matter how old they are. If you know the student is a public or private school student, it doesn't matter. And then if the student is if Jeremy went to an athletic game outside the state of Texas and then he wanted to, hit on a student that was there that was, in her cheerleader uniform. So if he was there and, he knows she's a student at the Louisiana school, her age doesn't matter and he can still be held criminally responsible. Principals are now also required to report in addition to the superintendent. Both the principal and the superintendent have 7 days from the date they learned of the information to make the report. If they don't report, then their certification is really what's on the line, and ESPEC will instigate a investigation into that. Sanctions for failure to report, they can also be sanctioned with an administrative penalty of $500 up to $10,000. They haven't really adopted the rules on exactly how that's going to work, but, could you imagine your principal being fined essentially $10,000 for failing to report one of his teachers? It's a scary thing for a principal, especially in a school this large where, APs deal with a lot too with our teachers, and they, of course, would be held to the same standards. Their certificate would be suspended until the sanction was paid for certain, maybe indefinitely, depending upon the facts of the situation. And then there's a state jail felony for intentional failure to report in an effort to conceal. They required educators to sign an affidavit now that says, I've never been involved or investigated for being involved with for an inappropriate relationship with a student or minor when they apply to a school district. There's the aiding and abetting prohibition that we talked about earlier that was, you can't help your buddy who was in an inappropriate relationship get a job at another school. And then there's some new things where they're going to require school districts now to develop policy and implement policy designed to prevent inappropriate electronic communication. It has to specifically allow an employee not to disclose their personal cell numbers. And then it has to include information on reporting student misconduct. We are currently in the process of developing those. TASB, which is the Texas Association of School Boards, has a group that drafts and develops policy, especially that is legally required in the state of Texas. And so we typically wait on those drafts of policy. And that's kind of where we're stuck in the process at is they've got, 800 and something school districts in the state of Texas that they have to get all prepared and sent out. And then Harvey hit and we all kind of went crazy and they kind of stopped policy drafting to respond to those schools that really needed a lot of assistance. So they're back in policy mode, and we should be getting those soon. So we'll know exactly what they say and whether PISD decides to tighten them up, or if, you know, TASB's proposed language is strong enough. Then now we also have to give notice to the parent of misconduct. So used to, when someone engaged in an inappropriate relationship with a student or minor, we could only tell them, you know, the employee has been disciplined according to the student code of conduct. Now we have to tell them who the person was, what happened, whether the educator resigned or was terminated, whether or not they were reported to SBEC, and we have to do it in writing as soon as feasible. So now I have to give mom or dad a written letter that they could, like, take to a news station or throw up on Facebook and really, shame this educator, whether it was a truthful or, you know, untruthful allegation. And so then I end the report or not to report section really with a statement that SBEC got from a teacher that observed, you know, things that she thought was inappropriate but didn't report it. And, you know, they said, I typically remain in my classroom until 5:30 or 6 most afternoons to grade papers, gather lesson resources, etc. Walking to my car, I frequently observed a teacher leaning against her car, engaged in conversation with one of my 8th grade students. I often left feeling uneasy. It didn't appear that appropriate for this teacher to be chatting with a student in this manner. Their proximity seemed flirtatious. Usually there were only 2 cars left in the parking lot, mine and hers. 2 months later, the teacher was suspended for having an inappropriate relationship with a student. Ultimately, she lost her job, and the student was transferred to another school. I should have reported what I observed to my principal. Now it's too late.
I do have a question. Somebody who's watching live on Facebook. Kat Marsh said recently the head athletic trainer that she knows stepped down. So does the school district report, or since he stepped down voluntarily, does it get swept away?
So if the school district has reason to believe that the educator engaged in an inappropriate relationship with a student or minor, and their resignation was related to those allegations, which in this case, I mean, I can't speculate, but depending upon the particular facts, I mean, I'm not, you know, privy to what exactly went on or what the school knew. But certainly assuming that the school knew that he did in fact engage in inappropriate relationship with a student or minor, the superintendent would be required to report to SBEC regardless of whether or not it was a resignation or not. Okay, so wrapping it up, I had a video, we'll skip that. Questions, if there are any. I know I'm running short on time, so thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being here. If you know, you can submit email questions to Jeremy, and then we'll try to get answers, I guess, if that's appropriate.
All right, so I do want to cover, they just have to go to the next class, so mm-hmm. The students are leaving. I do want to cover some tips to avoid the gray areas. So one thing that we just did was switch to Remind, and I had actually emailed you, hey, does it really make a difference? Because my phone is actually property of the school. Like, they pay for the phone, they pay for the
right
for the phone bill. And so it's not like it's my personal phone if I'm texting a kid, but I at the same time could delete those messages if there was something questionable.
Yes.
But with Remind, I can't. Like, it's all there. And so in the situation where the school provides my phone, how is that different?
So it is different, because even if I provide your phone, you can still delete the text messages. And so when I go back to our service provider to ask for those messages or to try to pull them, I can't get the content of the message. I can only get the specific, you know, times that messages were sent back and forth. So it's a little bit limiting in that way, versus Remind is supposed to, my understanding of it is that it is supposed to keep a log of every message that's ever sent, essentially. So I could direct an employee to print those and turn them in. You know, the Remind is an individual tool, though. It's not something that I don't have access, you know, as an educator. You know, I would have to still rely on you to provide those to me. But it's just more secure in the sense that you don't have the student's specific cell phone number. They don't have your specific cell phone number. It's perceived to be a way that you can kind of create a way to communicate with a student in a safe manner, so that you're not sharing your cell phone number, you're not putting it in the kid's hands so that they can choose to text you. Because I think, you know, we're forgetting sometimes too that students target teachers. Now, that doesn't mean a teacher doesn't willingly fall into that trap sometimes, but I've had, you know, enough involvement in cases where a teacher has, you know, where a student started that conversation. It wasn't the teacher that approached the student. It's just then that the teacher continued to engage in that conversation. So I think Remind at least protects you in that way, where your kids are less likely to send inappropriate messages back to you.
All right. So I know that personally, like, I've had a situation just recently, you know, I'm in here dealing with an injury, and I've been using Remind, but my kids have my phone number either from previous years or whatever. But one of them had to call me, hey, I need you to get out here if there's an injury. And so then for me, it's a little different situation. I'm like, well, is that, do I need to tell them, no, you can't call me, make the coach call me? Or
no, I mean, I think, but you're, so there are multiple things here. You know, we have to look at it from the standpoint of what is all of, we're not going to look at a student called you. You're going to look at the full context of the situation. So you're going to, you're going to look at, I'm going to be able to then go back and verify. The coach said, you called him. What was the context? You know, I mean, the student is going to tell me the context of the conversation was I told him, you know, there was an injured student. The people around the student that called you are going to say, yeah, he told him there was an injured student. The coach is going to go, I told, you know, John to call him because there was an injured student. So when you do an investigation, the evidence that you find is going to reveal what the pattern is. I will say, though, that in the years that I have worked it, you know, and been involved in school law, I've only really been involved in one allegation that there wasn't some sort of truth or inappropriate conduct involved. Now, the allegation may have been, you know, that somebody had sex and we find out, well, it wasn't quite there, but it, you know, there was still some smoke to that fire. But in particular, with the one case that I was involved in, you know, it was a coach that student made an allegation, you know, said it happened at this specific time. Police were involved due to the nature of the allegation. And through the police evidence and, you know, the police's investigation and the district's investigation, ultimately it came down to there was no way that, you know, the allegations happened in the way that they were alleged, because at that time the coach was on a bus, you know, 3 hours away with his team at a different, you know, event, and wasn't physically present, you know, at the time the student insisted it happened. They went back and reviewed video. There was no video because the coach wasn't present. I mean, so we were able to definitively prove that that specific allegation was more than likely, you know, not true.
Gotcha. Okay. So we talked about several of the social medias, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, mm-hmm. Instagram. Again, there was a teacher locally that basically got fired for sending X-rated Snapchats to one of her students that she was obviously involved with. And Snapchat is designed to disappear, but obviously
students can screenshot it.
Yeah, they screenshot it. And now you can actually save those.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's what happened, is there was several students that screenshotted that Snapchat, and then the teacher ended up going and saying, hey, this is, I screwed up. All these kids have this naked picture mm-hmm. of me on Snapchat. And so obviously don't send nudes, like you said earlier, but what are some of the other tips on social media for avoiding the gray area?
I mean, really, we're hoping that, you know, when TASB promulgates the new policy, that we're getting some really clear advice on it. Part of the problem is that, you know, we as a society have moved into this social media world without really thinking about the full implication of it. So, you know, I try to tell folks, you know, I wouldn't Snapchat with my students. If I have an Instagram and it's public, then fine, everybody can see everything. You know, I try to say, you know, I don't think friending your students on Facebook or Instagram or anything like that is really, you know, a best practice, if that makes sense. I have, you know, I know other lawyers and or other educators have said, you know, it's okay to do it if you do it on your, if you have like a professional page. I go with the, you know, don't put it out there if you wouldn't be okay with it being on the 5 o'clock news or your grandmother reading it, because you know, whether it's on a private page or not, you know, even if you're friending former students, it's sending it to their little sister who's a current student. You're still putting yourself at risk. I know that sounds terrible, but I would almost try to say limit any social media involvement you have with students. I know that in Pasadena, like our fine arts group, and it's something that we're considering for coaches even, is, you know, have another adult. If you have to text message a student, include another adult educator on the Snapchat, whether it's your coach and your assistant coach, or it's the student's parent and the coach, or, you know, there's less likelihood that you're going to say something you think is inappropriate if your colleague is reading it too, or the kid's parent is reading it too.
Yeah, and then obviously there's another party that doesn't delete the message. So if you and the student agree to delete the message, then you have to get the other adult to delete it too.
Right, correct, yeah. It gives us a little bit more leeway in what we can and can't obtain through evidence. But, you know, for me, that's not 100%, you know, the reason why I say that. I mean, I really do say it. If you're worried about inappropriate allegations, then that's an easy way for you to protect yourself. There's another adult that saw the message that didn't interpret it as inappropriate.
All right, so here's kind of a personal one. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we've done in my class is we're setting goals. Mm-hmm. And so one of my goals that I give them as an example is a fitness goal. And my fitness goal is to be able to bench 350 pounds. Mm-hmm. And so I've put on social media like Instagram or Facebook or whatever pictures of me working out. And sometimes I work out without a shirt. Now, I haven't ever really thought, like, I don't tell my kids, hey, follow me on Instagram. And then I put pictures of me shirtless. But my Instagram is open, but I'm working out without my shirt. Is that
I mean, I think
area?
You have to consider the appropriateness of the situation too. You know, if you're engaged in workout activities without a shirt, more than likely, okay. I've also had educators, though, that, you know, go to get a boudoir photo shoot and change their Facebook photo to something from the boudoir photo shoot. Probably more problematic type of, you know, skin showing. So really, it is more about context and what's going on and why is it there than, you know, exactly what it is. I think it would be very different, you know, if a female teacher, you know, posts a picture, you know, post birth and has her baby on her chest. Her parts are covered up, but it may, you know, be a little risque, or, you know, they're showing parts that she wouldn't normally show. But given the context of the photograph, is it appropriate or not appropriate? It's probably fine. More likely than not, it's definitely more appropriate probably than a boudoir photo shoot. You know, if she's got her friends on her Facebook page or her students on her Facebook page. It's really almost a fact by fact, case by case situation. It's hard to really say, you know, yes, that's okay. Two thumbs up, go ahead. But it's, you know, use common sense. If you can explain it, and you can, you know, tell your boss, and that wouldn't weird you out. It wouldn't weird you out to go to your boss and say, hey, you know, we're doing a fitness challenge. My fitness was to bench press. I've posted these pictures. You're probably safe, you know. But if you don't want to go tell your boss about your boudoir photo shoot, you probably shouldn't share it where students can find it.
Hopefully I don't ever have to tell my boss about me doing a boudoir photo
shoot. But I mean, you know, it comes up.
Yeah, it could. So, okay, any other social media, again, avoiding the gray? Because, like I said, it really is innocent, me posting a picture. Now, say I use my phone that the school provides me, and I send a picture of me, like, flexing in the mirror in the weight room to my wife. Is that something that's going to get me in trouble?
Typically not, unless you leave your phone out where a student can get it and sees it. I mean, I have had a situation where, you know, an employee sent a very inappropriate, well, I mean, I guess you could say inappropriate. It was, you know, showing lots of things, photographed to their significant other. The problem was then is it was saved on their iPad. They handed their iPad to a student and told a student to do something on it. What is a student going to do with their teacher's iPad? The first thing they're going to do is go through the pictures, you know, that's just what they do. I mean, they're going to look, if you hand it to them and it's unlocked, they're going to float through the pictures. Well, they went through the pictures. They found the inappropriate photograph. They took a picture of it with their cell phone, and then it's all over a school. So then it becomes a problem, you know, at the point that it comes back and affects the school environment or, you know, becomes a, I mean, the problem is in most school districts in their DFBB local policy, which is the non-renewal policy for contract employees, there's a provision in that that says any activity, you know, school related or otherwise, that given the publicity or attention to it hinders your effectiveness can be problematic. I mean, that's a grounds for non-renewal, essentially. So what you want to make sure is that if you're going to do that, that's probably fine. But I don't, you know, shirt off flexing in the mirror picture, not something I'm terribly concerned about. You know,
if it's
underwear, bottoms off, you know, topless for a female, probably should refrain from doing that on a work-related device or any device that a student is going to have access to. You know, it's a little different if the student steals the phone and, but, you know, I've had them where they physically hand, you know, an iPad to the kid or something and it's there.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I wanted to talk about is the gray area, the stuff that it would be completely innocent.
I mean, and it is a case by case basis. Yeah. I've had situations where a student stole a teacher's phone, went through text messages to her husband, you know, found a photograph and
did something
with it. And, you know, you have to talk about, you know, what do we do? Is the teacher going to be able to go back in that classroom? Are the parents, you know, depends on how big it blows up too. Is the school able to contain the issue and only that kid had it and we're able to catch him and get his parents involved before it, you know, atomic bomb kind of blows up? Or did the news have it at 5 o'clock and we didn't know about it until it showed up on the news? You know, it really is about management and whether or not to what extent that teacher can remain effective in that position.
All right. I can't think of anything else like specific gray area questions. Anything else you got?
I mean, I don't have anything else. I just, you know, it really is common sense. You know, if, and again, I go back to the, if you didn't want your grandma to read it, yeah, I say the same thing about communication with students. If it's not something that you think your grandma would be okay reading, don't send it to a student. I wouldn't send memes to a student. I wouldn't send, you know, funny, risque videos to a student. It's one of those things where you utilize common sense. If you wouldn't want another adult sending it to your child, or you wouldn't want your grandma to read it, or you wouldn't want it on the front of the newspaper, don't send it.
Easy enough. Just don't send it. If it's questionable, just don't do it. That's one of the other things. If you think at all that it's wrong, it probably is.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, it's are they tights? Are they leggings? They're always tights. They're not leggings if you have to ask. Is it a shirt or a dress? Well, it's a shirt if you have to ask us is it a shirt or a dress? If it's short enough to be a shirt, it's a shirt.
All right. And also I want to remind you that School Health wants to give away a $100 gift card every other month to listeners of Sports Medicine Broadcast. So sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/schoolhealth. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/schoolhealth. Again, Jody said if you want to ask her a specific question like Cat Dish, she texted me, but you could email me, which is info@sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, or you can hit me up on Twitter, which is Mr. Jeremy Jackson, and then I can get those to Jody. We can kind of work through those and go from there. And again, understand that your school district, your state, your employer is going to be slightly different, so make sure you understand. But these rules in general are really good ideas to avoid getting in trouble in jail, getting fired from your job, and just in general, best practices for working with minors. So again, I have Jody's presentation linked in the show notes, which is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/jailtime will be this episode. So if you want to look over her PowerPoint that she went through today, and then I've got the things that we discussed kind of jotted down in there as well. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/jailtime. We'll have links to everything we talked about there. Jody, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
For Jeremy, my Sports Medicine One kids, Jody, that is a wrap.